With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
And if you're one of our patrons, this is your extended ad-free version of this week's show. If you're not yet a patron but would like to get our ad-free extended versions, listen and interact with us live, much more, head to patreon.com/UKTech. And I should say thank you to everyone who's been writing in response to the message we put out in the feed and on the Patreon blog about some of the new tiers that we're introducing, new perks. If you haven't listened to that yet, do give it a chance to woo you into consideration. But we're probably going to introduce those over the next week or so. But feedback always welcome, of course, to that hello@techpodcast.uk. We've got a few new patrons recently. Stephen, William, Brian Creevy, Jamie, Ross. I don't know why only one of them has a surname, but you are all very much appreciated. Thank you for joining us or upgrading your patronage. You are stars in our eyes, Ian.
Yes, very much so.
Well, later on, we're going to be joined by a familiar voice, so put on your excitement pants. That's coming. But first, let's talk about ISPs.
Yay! Don't put those excitement pants on just yet.
The band of broad, or broadband, to use common parlance, is the topic of this new story. Ars Technica wrote that internet service providers in the UK will now automatically refund customers for outages in landline, phone and broadband service, and also for missed appointments or delays in starting new service. Ars wrote that when a customer's landline or internet service goes out and is not fully fixed, Ian, repaired to its former glory within 2 business days, that ISP will automatically issue £8 refunds per day, according to our good old regulator, Ofcom. Mm. It said, that being Ofcom, you will receive an initial £8 if the service is not fixed 2 full working days after you report it, and then £8 for each full day it is still not fixed after that. Refunds will be £25 for each missed appointment, specifically when an engineer doesn't show up for a scheduled appointment. Bit of a word echo there. Apologies. Or when the appointment is cancelled with less than 24 hours notice. There will also be a £5 a day compensation when a provider fails to start up new service on the promised installation date. So if you have a really terrible ISP, you can be in some, you know,
make a living out of this.
You can make a living, or at least your money back.
Yeah. Well, I mean, given that some people are probably paying £20 a month for their broadband, you know, if they've got a, you know, 3-day outage, they could be looking at, you know, 3 months.
That's true. I mean, if you had 10 days out, I mean, it's very rare, I think.
I think it's almost unheard of, but I mean, there will always be people who will have that. Like, there will be situations where something happens. I'm thinking trees bringing lines down, that kind of stuff, where it's just not easy to fix and will take some time. And
it makes you wonder if there'd be an exemption for natural disasters.
I don't think there is.
I mean, a tree falling down is not a disaster. I don't want to conflate that with actual disaster. But you know what I mean?
Say if a phone exchange catches fire or something. I mean, obviously, it's quite unlikely.
Has that ever happened?
I don't know, but, you know, it's theoretically possible. You're looking at, you know, maybe, what, 2,000, 3,000 people who
More.
Would all lose broadband. You wouldn't be able to restore it in time, and therefore you'd be paying out huge money. But, I mean, like I said, I do not think that is very likely to happen, but it's a possibility.
Are you a telephone exchange? Have you burst into flames?
Are you on fire?
Are you on fire? Let us or the fire department know. But seriously, I think this is a good move because, if nothing else, it incentivizes customer service and speedy resolution.
Well, can I tell you why I think that they might not be?
Have you got a negative point?
I do, but it's not negative. So I have a feeling that this is going to actually make it more difficult to get an engineer appointment. Uh-huh. So if you think about it, say if an engineer is tasked with doing 10 appointments a day, if there's a penalty for missing some, because you don't know as an engineer how long it's going to take you to fix a problem. So you might get to a house and you might find that the job that you thought would take 10 minutes takes 2 hours. You're then going to have to, you're going to bump all of those appointments. I don't know some of them, I don't know how much... How much do you have to have it moved by to, for it to count as a missed appointment? So what, for example, what is a company like BT saying that they will, what times frame will they say? Is it a day? Is it a half day or something like that?
The wording is that if an appointment is cancelled with less than 24 hours notice, so I assume that missing a 3 hour window would not be acceptable. Mm. For example, if they say they're going to be here at 2, and actually they show up at 5, but you nipped out to the shop at 5, they wouldn't count that as a missed appointment. No. They would say it was unfortunate timing, but we're not giving you £25.
No, but so here's the thing. So I can only imagine that what will happen is they will be much more cautious with the amount of engineer visits they will commit to. So that's going to mean that your broadband is going to take, you know, longer to get installed. Or if you want to upgrade, they're just going to say, well, we haven't got an appointment for you for 3 weeks. They're just going to be much more cautious. They're going to have to scale back the number of appointments they can commit to a day. And I think that could have a negative impact on it.
But I wonder as well, and I do agree, I do think there's a lot of validity to the point. But I also think that I would imagine probably like 80 to 90% of all engineer callouts are probably for the same, you know, very large percentage of problems, you know, where switching it off and on again or getting an engineer on a remote line to reset something is probably a fix. And that very rarely does it need to be more than that. And so there's probably more time allotted to each of those visits to accommodate for that.
Yeah.
Therefore, you can make up some of that back by still putting in this number of appointments.
Now, I've just had a thought as you were talking.
Good.
So engineer comes to your house. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, obviously, there will be times when an engineer will come and it will be maybe if your speed's not what you'd expect, or if you're changing a product, say you're going from ADSL to fiber, it might be that an engineer would come. And I don't think it's likely in most cases because it's mostly done from the exchange, isn't it?
But I mean, I do remember when I had my Virgin installed in my house when I bought it, they insisted on sending an engineer around, even though I was pretty damn confident I could open the box and plug in a cable.
That's changed a lot. Like when I moved into my flat now, I
self-install.
Yes.
I'm slightly bored of this tangent.
Well,
carry on
sure.
with your previous point.
Yes, I mean, so the other thing, what I was going to say was, my concern is that an engineer would get to your house, spend half an hour working on the problem, not be able to fix it, and then go, I've got to go because I've got another appointment. Therefore, he hasn't missed the appointment with you, but he's turned up and you've not got a satisfactory resolution. So again, that could have an impact on customer satisfaction.
That's interesting, isn't it? The idea of showing up at someone's door so it registers on the GPS and then leaving.
Yeah.
It's like when call center people call you and they're just making sure you pick up and the phone, and then the line goes dead because they just need to register that they called someone and the number was real and they answered.
And obviously there is another issue here, in that particularly with services going down, if you think about it, there are only really two, maybe three providers of broadband services in the UK, right? I mean there are more, but like of the majority of people are on a Virgin product, an Openreach product, or their or say Kingston upon Hull or whatever that one. I forget what it's called.
City
now.
Fiber.
Yeah. Or
Hyper
those
Optic.
Or those companies. Yeah. So there, I mean, there are more now, but the majority of people are not on those services. So they're on the big three, right? So what this is going to mean is that basically every problem that an ISP has is more likely to be an Openreach issue. I mean, obviously, there will be occasions where ISPs have their own infrastructure fail, but mostly because they're in control of that, they can fix it very quickly. But if I'm running an ISP and there's a problem that only Openreach can fix, because let's be honest, most of them are renting the lines, you know, that way, then it's going to be Openreach's problem. Now, I don't know how this works. ISP is going to go then to Openreach for compensation?
Shall I tell you the answer?
Yes.
Doesn't matter. If it doesn't get fixed, you get some money.
Well, no, that's true, and it doesn't matter. But I mean, obviously, this is going to have another impact, isn't it? Because it is going to put prices up.
No.
Are you sure?
Yes. I don't think you can pass on compensation related.
No, but it will have an impact on what companies want to increase their charges by. Because
competition all sorted out. We've got so much competition, particularly in the cities here, yeah, for broadband, that you could never get away with that.
Well, perhaps, but there are some services that aren't, that don't have any competition. There is no competition for your 350 meg Virgin, is there? BT doesn't offer that product.
BT does, but in very limited areas.
Yeah, and I assume it's fibre to the home, not fibre to the cabinet. There is supposed to be a 300 meg.
EE definitely offers an over 300 megabit
does
product.
It?
Yeah, and it uses BT, but it's in very limited areas. Very limited areas. But I think we're going a little bit too far down this rabbit hole. So let's wrap it up like a present we don't want anymore. And let us know any thoughts on this you have. hello@techpodcast.uk. That is, of course, assuming your internet works. Well, last year, companies in the UK were mandated by the government to publish how much they pay male and female employees, so the gap between the two became public knowledge. The deadline was 12 months ago today at the time of recording, and I've been digging through the data on tech companies to see how much has changed. Now, I looked at the mean averages when reporting this story for Bloomberg, and I'll include a link to the show notes and in the MP3 description for the episode, so do look out for that. And I saw that Facebook now pays women 1.8% less than men, which is a decline from the 0.9% gap a year ago. Google has slipped slightly as well and now pays women 19% less than men on average, compared to 17% less a year ago. And women now occupy 21% of the highest paid jobs there, compared to 22% last year. Amazon has a few subsidiaries in the UK, but I picked the main one, and that one fared a lot better, actually. It pays women 0.5% less than men, compared to 2.1% a year ago, and women and men occupy about the same number of the highest paid jobs as they did last year. Now, Google's actually a particularly interesting one, because this week The Telegraph wrote in a completely separate story that the company paid an average of £226,000 to its UK staff in 2018, but that's a topic for a completely different podcast. To help us put the pay gap in UK tech companies in context, we've got a voice many listeners will recognise as something of a regular source of wisdom on the show now, particularly when it comes to diversity in the British tech scene. It's of the Show Me The Way podcast, Naomi Kerble.
Hello, thanks for having me back.
Well, thank you for coming back yet again. You've been a big hit with our listeners. We keep getting emails about you, so we're giving them what they want. Whether we're giving you what you want is
loving it. I'm loving it.
Is another question. But Naomi, you've seen these figures that I've been digging up on these the UK tech companies. What stood out for you the most?
Okay, well, I'm trying not to scream. I don't have a pillow at work to scream into, so I've just had to resort to biting my fist. What stood out to me, Uber, nearly 9% less. WeWork, 23% less. And then Badu, which is, am I saying that? Badu?
I say Badu.
Badu, yeah. which is Bumble. Bumble, well,
operates Bumble.
33% less. I mean, this is total madness.
Yeah.
And the fact that, as you say, we are overall seemingly getting worse is just so depressing. I was looking at some reaction from the Fawcett Society, which looks into equality in the workplace. And what they're saying is, and I totally agree with them, the regulations are just not tough enough. The government needs employers to publish action plans which actually mandate that they have to make meaningful changes, and there have to be meaningful sanctions as a result of that. Because this is meant to be a catalyst for change, but it's not.
Hmm. Well, if it is a catalyst for change, it's not making the change that the catalyst exists for. I mean, the whole idea is kind of naming and shaming to a certain extent, isn't it? It's that if you're forced to publish something and you don't want to look bad, then you make the figures better by changing the issue that caused them in the first place, right?
And listen, I hate to bring Brexit into this, because we should actually just ban the word for a little while. We've had a week off, I feel. But actually, I think that Brexit is part of the reason for bumping this off companies' agendas. They're so focused on their strategic vision around how they're going to handle Brexit that pay equality, let's call it across diverse sections of their companies, is just not on the agenda as it should be. I think it's there. I just think it's bumped right down.
I do wonder whether more should be done with the publication of these figures. I mean, part of it is in the hands of journalists to, you know, make reminders a year ahead of publication to remind themselves to go and check these figures and do a compare and contrast. I'm not trying to blow my own trumpet. I'm not the only one who's done this week. But I'll tell you what was interesting about this whole reporting process is that companies really don't like it when you publish figures that they've had to publish on the website. And, you know, one of the companies that I approached for this emailed me afterwards and asked if we would use the median average rather than the mean average. Yeah. On the website, and I said, "Well, we used the mean last year, and so I need to use the mean this year." And their fundamental problem was that it made them look bad. And my heart wanted to say, "Well, I'll tell you a way of making yourselves not look bad next year: pay people a fairly,
Do something,
make a difference."
It.
To clarify, the median is where you calculate the average based on all of how
the median is like the middle figure from low to high,
right?
And the mean is where you add everything up and
divide it by the number.
Exactly, yeah. And some people say that the median is a fairer way of measuring averages because it sort of accounts for outliers, which is true. Mm. But the bottom line is that the companies have to publish both of these figures. We used the mean last year, so we use the mean again this year. The fact is, for the companies that we were showing both last year and this year's figures for, because some of the companies didn't have to file this because they weren't big enough last year, but they are now, they didn't have one to compare it to. So perhaps, yes, they could have had change. But the other part of me wants to say, well, you know, next year, when you do make a big change and we still use the mean, then you will look like you've made a huge improvement compared to everyone else who's only made a marginal improvement.
I mean, I've always sort of thought about pay. And I mean, obviously, selfishly, from a male perspective, I'm, you know, concerned about whether I'm earning as much as other people doing the same job. But and if I was a woman, I would feel exactly the same way about it. But I don't think that in this country, people are very good at talking about what they earn. And I feel like, you know, we should be a bit more open about it. And then perhaps there'll be far less of this. Because if I was working with someone who was doing the same job as me, and they happened to be a woman and I happened to be a man, and I was paid more for some reason, I would be as angry as them, I think. I just don't think it's justifiable.
Amen, brother.
Yes.
Absolutely. This is something that I come back to time and time again. It happens within my own friendship group. People will not talk about how much they are earning. It drives me absolutely crazy. And if we had a transparent pay framework, then there would be no issue.
Yeah.
Because you just go, hey, Ian, you're doing really well. I want to do as well as Ian.
Yeah.
Hey, boss, let me do as well as Ian.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something. I once had a very awkward conversation. This goes back many years with a boss when I was inheriting... I inherited the inbox of my predecessor in a particular position. And this was a decade before GDPR.
Yeah.
And by pure chance... by doing a search for something to find out, you know, what a freelancer had been commissioned or something like that, I found an email from my predecessor to his boss, who was my boss, about the salary he was on, and it was notably higher than mine.
Mm.
And this was, you know, me, a man, taking over from another man, complaining to another man. There were no women involved in this at all, but I was very, very cross.
Control F thoughts, question mark?
Yes.
Yeah, a little bit like that. And I mean, I don't need to go into what happened as a result, but the feedback from my manager was that it's not a very good way of arguing for pay rise by saying, look at what this, you know, telling your boss, I found out what my predecessor was on, why am I not on the same? But the further down the line we go with this, with the gender diversity pay gap issue, the more I think, I think that's okay. I think you should.
Yeah, and I just don't really understand why companies are doing this. Like, I just don't...
Doing what?
Why is there a disparity? I don't...
Well, mate, I mean...
You know, I mean, hiding it for one thing.
We could go on and talk about decades of inequality and managers giving other people more money because they're managers.
Why they're doing it is because it makes business sense, right?
If you save money, don't they?
Yeah, if you can get something for cheaper, if you can get a product for cheaper, then you are going to buy that product.
Mm.
Even if the other product is potentially going to do the job in a different way or better, or however you see it. But if it is a case of viewing workers as numbers rather than as individuals, then, you know, it makes business sense not to A, reveal what each other what each person is being earned, and B, not actually keep everyone equal. I suppose it makes business sense.
Yeah, and I mean, but it's just so depressing, isn't it? Like, I mean, obviously people may well be happy in what they're earning, but also there is a kind of thing that, like, you know, there is always a penny pinching thing that I don't, you know, and I've just gone off on this about this on Twitter about earnings for journalists in general.
You had a rant on Twitter.
I did have a rant on Twitter. It's surprising, isn't it? and you know, and it's getting worse. And I don't know if I'm earning the same as, you know, other people, but I suspect it's pretty equal because there's just not a lot of money around. But a lot of people were like, actually, yeah, we are aware of this problem, and some of us are trying to fight it. So I think that people will address problems like this if they're empowered to do so. And I guess a lot of men are probably just clued. And they don't think about it because it doesn't affect them. But like I said, I would, you know, you'd be mortified, wouldn't you, if you thought that a colleague was just, for some reason, because of their gender, earning less.
I wasn't so much, with gender, yeah. I mean, at the time with this incident of mine was not so much mortified as just annoyed.
Yes.
Because it wasn't a very well-paid job in the first place. Naomi, one question before I let you go. One of the things that interests me, I was trying to think about, you know, causes for this and, you know, why isn't it as simple as just paying everyone the same for the same job, which is very, you know, idealistic, utopian ideal that isn't overnight achievable, but should be a goal, perhaps. Mm. But I did think, you know, from a position of someone who has been in charge of hiring people before now, if you are trying to hire a person from another company and that person is already on a higher salary than perhaps what you know you can hire somebody else for, but you really want that person, and that person is also at a company where they are very valued, and therefore maybe there's some leverage to pay them more to stay. Is it not kind of almost impossible to not artificially, even with the best of intentions, artificially overpay somebody simply because it's the only way to even get them to move industry, particularly if they're coming from a high-paying industry?
I think it's really hard, and I think that in that scenario, you create real stagnation in the work. You create real stagnation in the workforce. So, I think it is. I think that is really tricky. That creates a huge problem with competition. I wonder if you can offer other incentives. So I know at some companies I've worked for in the past, there are long-term incentive programs to keep employees interested, engaged with the workplace, and, you know, they will only vest after a couple of years. So that might be a way that people consider enticing new employees.
If anybody listening has any thoughts or you know, even better, experience with perhaps solving this issue, or not solving it, we'd all be in a very different place if you had, but have played a part in helping everyone else solve it, then do let us know. hello@techpodcast.uk. Do check out Naomi's show, Show Me the Way, as well, wherever you got this podcast from. And Naomi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me once again.
When MySpace announced that it had accidentally lost 12 years of content last month, former users were devastated to learn that many of their audio files, which they assumed would continue to exist on the site like a digital archive, had been lost forever. But the Internet Archive comes bearing good news, Ian. Having managed to salvage a collection of MP3s, it's calling the MySpace Dragon Horde.
Nice. Very grand.
This is, of course, per a write-up on Engadget. It was a very, very good write-up, which continued to say that the collection contains 490,000 tracks, allegedly gathered by an anonymous academic group that grabbed around 1.3 terabytes of music from the site to study between 2008 and 2010. This represents, Ian, a very small percentage of the total tracks lost, which, again, according to Engadget, is estimated to be around 53 million. But many users are nonetheless delighted with this haul.
Yes.
I am one of the people that is both delighted and also undelighted, because it's not actually the MP3s that I think needed salvaging from MySpace. It's MySpace that needs salvaging.
Well, presumably there is an archive of MySpace.
And it's on the Internet Archive.
Yes.
And I found one of my old MySpace pages.
Did you?
Which is miraculous. It's brilliant, I have to say.
Yes.
That's the stuff that I think people really want, unless they are users having created those MP3s.
I mean, you said earlier that, you know, people would have assumed that they that the archive would continue forever and it would never be blocked. I mean, that is such a foolish thing to think, you know, for any service online. I mean, you only have to look at if it doesn't get lost in a database corruption like this system obviously failed with, then it'll be something like Flickr, where they just change the rules so that you can only have 1,000 photos for free.
At least they give you a heads up.
They do give you a heads up, but a lot of people will just not have known. I mean, I don't think I've got a Flickr, and I wasn't particularly affected, but I didn't get an email about it. But I suppose that's because I wasn't affected. I've really run myself round in a circle there, haven't I? But a lot of people have missed it anyway, but then would you assume that your photos are safe on Flickr? I personally wouldn't ever assume that. I think it's just one of those things. You have to have backups of everything, even the stuff that you put in the cloud, because nothing lasts forever. Google shuts services at a rate of unbelievable pace. Goodbye, Google Plus.
But you have...
Inbox.
You've outlined almost entirely free ad-supported services.
Well, yes.
And the paid ones, historically, I think, have been better at...
Well, yes, because they're making money out of it. But people like free.
Yeah, but maybe more emphasis needs to be put on the risk being taken when you use that free service. Yeah. But there is a part of me that thinks, well, if you're using a free service, yes, good effort should be made to prepare you for mass deletion.
Mm.
But at the end of the day, you're not paying anything.
No. And you have probably no rights as a result.
But this is good.
Was there ever a paid version of MySpace, or was it all ad supported?
There was never a paid version, I don't believe. I think there was definitely something that art, like musicians and publishers, I think could use, where they had different tools, but I don't think they were paid for as such. But I'm not 100%. Maybe somebody listening will be able to fill us in on that. But I do love what the Internet Archive does. You know, it's an incredible resource. I use it a lot, and we'll talk about it. We're actually going to talk a little bit about it in the Patreon version later a little bit, 'cause we're going to talk about journalism and Facebook and a bunch of other stuff and how we check sources and facts. And I rely on the Internet Archive for you know, impartially and reliably for the most part, archiving previous versions of stories, yeah, and company websites and things like that. And the fact that it also archives audio and other things is just a huge bonus. Even if it is a bit slow, it's slow for a reason.
It is very slow. But, I mean, you can live with that because it is such a valuable resource.
Yeah.
And if we want it to be quicker, then we can all drop them a donation because, you know, they do good work and they're not profit-making, are they? And, you know, and there is no archive of the internet other than the Internet Archive.
Yeah.
And that is an issue because so much of what has been published online will not exist in 5 or 10 years. That's not the same with books. There will always be a copy of a book.
I do think, and this is going off tangent a little bit, but if the Internet Archive was ever in trouble of dying,
yeah,
I sort of think Google would just buy it.
Maybe, and that might not be a bad thing, or it might not be a good thing. I would say that the Internet Archive should receive funding from the same places that, you know, the Library of Congress and the British Library.
But libraries work with them. You know, you can actually loan books from libraries via the Internet Archive.
Oh, really?
And I only discovered this. It sounds totally, you know, pre-planned, but this isn't pre-planned. Only this week, I was looking for a book by... It's an author called James Gunn. He wrote a book called The Listeners.
Right.
It's like a collection of stories about first contact and things.
Oh, okay.
And I found a paperback copy on Amazon and bought it, and hopefully it'll be delivered by the time I get home today. Yeah. But the one place I found it in ebook format was on the Internet Archive, because I think it was like the Boston Library in the US had scanned it, and you could join a wait list to rent the PDF, and they just wouldn't give presumably they don't give the physical book out, and they don't let anyone who's already got the PDF copy, they don't loan it out to anyone who's already technically got access to it. So it's like...
That's weird.
It's good, though.
But there's a limited number of loans. Is that because you get... So basically, the way that libraries work is that every loan is tracked, right? And then authors receive a payment from the centralised, whatever, lending
Yeah.
And so presumably that's the same with the PDF. They have to restrict the ability of people to borrow it, because otherwise it would just be out of control. People would just take it without ever bothering to actually read it, and it would cost.
I believe that's the case. And there are also payments you can get from like academic institutions that photocopy pages and things like that. And I only know that because Kate, who has a book published, it's called The Fox of Richmond Park. It's an excellent read. I'm extremely biased, but I still think it's brilliant. She gets payments from people who, you know, have scanned it, and periodically she gets a bit of money.
Yeah.
That way. So.
And if it's, you know, serialized in a magazine abroad or something like that, then, you know, even, you know, there's all sorts of ways. There's a whole company, a company that manages journalists. If you write for a print publication, it's possible that that gets syndicated all around the world, and you wouldn't necessarily know it, but you may be entitled to money.
And I'll tell you what, that is definitely true, because when I worked at Condé Nast on Wired, we had a lot of freelancers writing features,
yeah,
and for online and for the magazine, yeah. And you know, the contracts were, I mean, different contracts for different people, I suppose, but there was definitely, you can definitely run into issues if someone wants to publish something elsewhere when it wasn't published, just published in the original material. I'm trying to hedge my words here, because I don't want to get anyone into trouble.
It's a funny situation that I think perhaps people don't realise, but usually these days, I think you would, if you wrote something for someone, it would be an exclusive, right? So you wouldn't be able to republish it elsewhere. But traditionally, authors have retained the copyright for anything they've had published on any site or in any magazine. So you could theoretically republish it again elsewhere.
You're used to hearing the smooth, velvet sound of Nate's voice drizzled over your ears like a warm eardrum syrup, topped off with the freshly squeezed citrus tang of an Ian Morris opinion. Supporters of the show at patreon.com/UKTech enjoy second helpings every week. So pull up a chair, find your nearest spoon, and tuck into a sumptuous extra helping with no commitment. If you have any allergies, please inform a waiter.
Let's move into the feedback. We've dragged Naomi back here to talk to us, because we have an email from Charlotte Stegall, who regular listener and patron, actually, who really liked the conversation we had the other week about getting young women and girls into science and technology subjects in school. She sent in three comments about this. We don't have time to go through all three, but I just picked one out that, for me, really felt like you would have an opinion on it, which is that she says, when companies do put effort into STEM stuff with a motivation of getting more girls interested, they do girl-only activities. You know, she said that she is absolutely against this. Half of the battle is women not feeling comfortable in STEM companies. And having worked in a very famous gaming company, I have first-hand experience of men not being completely comfortable with a woman working alongside them. The sexist and inappropriate comments were really hard to deal with at sometimes. We need to include boys because they need to be excited about STEM, but also because they need to see from an early age that girls also have a place in these roles. And she says, love the episode as always, and I love Naomi. So,
oh, Charlotte, I love you too. I thought that all of her comments were really spot on. I think we've talked about this a lot, Nate, creating male allies. And you've got to do that from the beginning. I totally agree with you, Charlotte. I think there is a place for women-based events, women's networking, women-focused events. I don't think that place is necessarily when these kids are young. I think it's better to have a safe space when you're older. You probably have more to moan about. You can probably discuss things like, you know, gender pay gaps and things like that in those spaces. But no, I agree with you wholeheartedly that it's better to get the boys and the girls together working alongside each other, because you're going to develop different things together. You're going to come up with new ideas that each one of you hadn't thought about. It's much better that way, in my opinion.
Well, thank you, Charlotte, for the message. Thanks, Naomi, for sticking around. I know you're late. You have things to do, so we're going to let you get out of here. I will show you the way.
Nice.
There's the door. I hope you'll come back through it. Thanks once again to Charlotte for emailing in. Of course, you can send your messages to hello@techpodcast.uk. Let's check in with our friend from Well, America. Tom Merritt, what's been going on in the wider world of tech news this week?
Thanks. This week on Daily Tech News Show, we talked about Facebook's PR burst, including why Mark Zuckerberg is calling for more regulation of Facebook. We discussed whether it's fair not to trust Google to keep its projects around after it has killed so many. Talked about machine learning to optimize growing conditions for food, why being old does not mean you can't handle the internet. And Laura Shin explained why DeFi, or decentralized finance, is the hot new trend in blockchain and cryptocurrency circles. All that and much more at dailytechnewsshow.com.
I had to contain a laugh just then, ladies and gentlemen, because Ian said this has been a weird show this week. And for those of you listening, even on our Patreon version, but certainly also on the free version, you won't have heard some of the rather bizarre tangents
that we've flown off down and weird things we've said.
But I've enjoyed them.
When you've invoked the devil's advocate twice.
Yes. See how much of that ends up going through to the edit. But thank you to our patrons supporting us, who actually, I suppose, the ones getting the... who do
get the uncut
version of the show, which at the moment is running at 1 hour, 10 minutes.
Oh, good grief, what have we done?
We'll experience some of those mad tangents. But if you listen to those and you think other listeners may value that type of content, then do obviously let us know at the usual places, and maybe we can make that part of the regular show. But... thank you to those of you supporting us every week. If you're not yet a patron but would like to get our ad-free versions and extended versions and all the stuff that we talk about quite a lot recently because we're changing up the tiers, head to patreon.com/UK Tech. Help us finish the month with one more patron than we had last month. And also, well, you can hear the 1 hour, 10 minute version of this show that contained, what's a polite way of putting it?
Nonsense.
No, I wouldn't say that. Considered...
nonsense.
Alternative words.
Considered alternative nonsense.
You can take over now.
Oh, thanks very much. Yes, those places that Nate mentioned, which are the usual places, include our email address, which is hello@techpodcast.uk. You can follow us on Twitter. It's @textmessagepod to keep up to date with the most important UK technology headlines throughout the week. And thanks to everyone listening to us on our free ad-supported feed. If you have a minute to leave us a review on iTunes, it's the best way of supporting us without spending a penny.
It really is. If you have a choice of, you know, being one of our $1 patrons or going and leaving a new review on iTunes,
we're happy with both.
I'm literally no preference to that, because one of them massively helps us spread our reach, and one of them helps us upgrade microphones.
For every review that we get that's good, it increases the chances of someone saying, I'd like to contribute to Patreon. And obviously we understand that not everyone wants to or can do that.
Yeah.
So by spreading the love, you're helping us pick up a few extra people, and we like reading the comments, don't we, really? Unless they're unfair, in which case we get cross.
I just like dancing in a pool full of happy listeners. From me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
I'm going for a lie down.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.